You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm bringing you a fascinating conversation with Matt Besser. This was recorded earlier this year at the Montreal Comedy Festival. Matt was kind enough to come along and talk to us about improv, about his own stand-up comedy, and as well as being a comic. And I saw him after this interview, in fact. I wish I'd seen it before. We recorded a TV show together at Just for Laughs, and he walked on and improvised his set. He's that kind of stand-up comic. Really excellent. And as well as that, he holds the distinction of being one of the four co-founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade, the UCB, one of the most influential improv comedy troupes ever to come out of the States. Matt founded that along with Amy Poehler, Matt Walsh and Ian Roberts. We're going to talk a little bit about that and a bit more about the origins of improv as we know it, the work of Del Close and how that went on to inform everything that followed after. And we also have a slight difference of opinion about Keith Johnston, who's on a very different tack improvisationally. Loads to enjoy here. Just a quick reminder. It's not a reminder because I haven't told you yet, but a pre-minder, if you will, that Matt Besser's stand-up special, Pot Humour, is brand new. It's just out now and you can get it wherever you get video. Video on demand, that is. It's on Apple, it's on Amazon, DirecTV, VOD, Spectrum VOD, and it's even on Xbox. I don't know if that's a playable version, I doubt it. And Matt's podcast, Improv for Humans, is available wherever podcasts are found. This is Matt Besser. So we've just, you've just performed in a live version of Improv for Humans here at the Montreal Comedy Festival. Which is, you said you'd taken a decision to interview them in character. The podcast is kind of quite free form. The podcast is whatever you want it to be.
Well, normally Improv for Humans, it's a lot like our stage show at the UCB Theater called ASCAT.
Yeah.
Which is, at ASCAT, we'll take a suggestion and the monologist will tell a story and then we'll do three scenes based on the story and then we'll do that again.
And the suggestion is just one word.
One word.
Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
And they'll tell a real story. So my podcast is based on that. And we'll get a suggestion usually off of Twitter if it's a live show from the audience. And then one of the four of us, it's usually four people, will tell a story and then we'll do some improv. It's usually one scene based off it and then we'll repeat. I have done Improv for Humans here at JFL, I think like 3 or 4 years ago. And I can't remember who was with me then, but it was three improvisers. But this time it just happened. There weren't many improvisers here on this Thursday. So I booked the Slar Brothers, who aren't necessarily improvisers, but friends of mine. And this guy who I just met, Thomas Middleton. I'm not even sure of his last name because I just met him an hour ago.
Okay, 2 hours ago. Sure.
But he's from UCB in New York, and he's here on character, the New Faces.
New Faces characters, yeah.
Yeah, so I decided, since they aren't improvisers per se, I know they can do characters and improvise as a character, whereas it's a little more difficult to improvise scenes just from scratch versus I know my character and I can improvise the bit of my character. So the Sklar brothers decided to be two agents called the Marx brothers. and Thomas was the JFL mascot, which he calls Giesel.
Yeah, which it was actually Victor. I missed the very beginning of the show and the improvisation of the name Giesel. I worked out who he was being throughout before it became explicit.
Someone did call him out on that and go, we've always heard your name was Victor.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we decided was pretty Anglo-centric to make a goblin have a very English name like Victor.
And so during that show, one of the Sklar brothers, and forgive me, I don't know their names, Randy and Jason, referred to you as, I can't remember the exact way he put it, but he referred to you as like one of our greatest improvisers or one of the...
Yeah, that was offensive, him saying one of. I agree with you.
Listen, this is you. For the, I guess you're not so famous in the UK, where majority of my listeners are. But you are known. You're one of the founders of UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade. You've been. You talked there about doing stand up for the first time in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You are part of the comedy firmament.
Okay.
I'm tricking you into digging yourself
up.
I did.
Start in the late 80s and early 90s in stand-up, and maybe your UK listeners don't know, but maybe it was the same in the UK, I don't know, but in the United States, there was a huge stand-up boom in the 80s, you know, that like Sam Kinison, Bobcat Goldthwait, and that whole crew was, and it stand-up clubs just popped up everywhere. It was crazy. And I moved to Chicago. There were 12 stand-up clubs just in the city of Chicago. And now they're not. There's probably 4 or whatever. But at that point, there was so many. And every city was like that.
And
Too many stand-up clubs.
Like little clubs? Or were they like proper clubs, chicken in a basket?
Some were small. Kind of thing. But like in Chicago at the time, the Improv, Catch a Rising Star, the Funny Firm, the one that's still there, Zany's. So these are all huge names in stand-up clubs. Those were all the biggest clubs, Catch, Improv. Have you heard of Catch a Rising Star?
I've heard of it, but I don't know much about
it. It was one of the biggest ones back in the day. But yeah, to answer your question, all the legit places, every city had probably the legit clubs or the big name clubs. And then what, like you're saying, small clubs that might do blues on a given night of the week too. Mm-hmm. But in other words, there's this boom. It was crazy. Me being in college in the middle of the boom, I was like, I want to be a stand-up. I didn't even know what improv was. I literally did not have any idea about the form of long-form improv. Mm-hmm. I knew short form from Whose Line Is It Anyway, but I didn't know.
So that existed at the time? I never know, because we had a version of... Did we have the same version of Whose Line that you had?
Well, I'm talking about your version.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
That's all I knew.
Okay.
Or that's all most people, I'd say. If you said improv, they would say... Whose Line, they would assume what we call short form improv.
Yeah.
I assume you call it the same thing. I don't know. Game based improv.
Sure.
So I didn't even know what it was. I did stand up. I started during the boom. And of course, in the early 90s, it all started to die too. Like all those clubs started to die off. There was way too many people doing stand up. It was crazy. But this was in the middle of me starting. And I moved to Chicago to do it. And that's where the hub of improv is. That's pretty much where this long form improv was born, is arguably Chicago. Mm-hmm. Some other cities too, but you would have to say that that's where all long form improv comes from.
So just that origin in Chicago, were there kind of some sort of cultural factors native to Chicago that created that?
Or was it just random?
Okay.
There was the University of Chicago and a lot of theater people around that scene who may not necessarily have gone to the university, but hung out. And Elaine May, Mike Nichols, do you know those names?
Not so much.
Well, Mike Nichols you do, because he's the famous director. He did Mrs. Robinson. He did...
The Graduate.
The Graduate.
Got you. Yes, I do know.
Elaine May, her and Nichols are kind of known as the first improvisers because they had this duo called Nichols and May, and this is the 60s, and they would do sold out shows. And a lot of it was sketch, but some of it was give us a word and we'll improvise. So they were the first successful improv duo, and they came out of Chicago. And also a guy who came out of Chicago was Del Close. And that it was kind of a threesome because Del was in love with Elaine and so was Michael. And that's a very interesting story all in itself.
Sure.
There's a book called Improv Nation, which covers Nichols and May a lot. But anyway, Del, Elaine May directed Ishtar. She's famous for that wreck. But she's also directed some great movies. But anyway, he became the guru and never left Chicago, really. And he was the one who really developed it. And there was this big comedy feud between Second City and the guy who ran it, Bernie Sollins, and Del Close, who was also at Second City. And Del always believed improv can be its own show. And Bernie Sollins of Second City believed, no, it's only a tool for making sketch comedy. It's a rehearsal tool.
Okay.
It should not be its own show and people should not pay for it.
Okay.
And they were very adamantly, publicly feuding about it for years.
There's no ground on that, is there? There's no compromise.
Well, the funny thing is Bernie Sollins ran Second City for many years and Del was hired and fired from Second City many times. Del worked he was on the original SNL as a consultant. He was on the original SCTV as a consultant. This guy is like behind the scenes of all these major comedies. So he would get hired and fired all the time. He's also, if you've seen the movie Wired about John Belushi, supposedly the guy who did heroin with him and gave him the heroin. So he has a long heroin past.
Sure.
Unfortunate junkie past. So even as being a genius, he was a troublesome junkie too. So he would be directing Second City and have serious alcohol and heroin problems and get fired. So his personality, and he was also a cantankerous motherfucker, and to me in a good way, but he rubbed a lot of people wrong. So he was this guru of improv, but fought the sketch establishment. So it was like improv versus big sketch.
Okay.
And Bernie Sollins, Second City was where all the money was, you know, in comedy, in sketch. So if you wanted to make money doing sketch, you had to go through Second City, obviously. No one else is doing it. Until the late 80s into early 90s when this place called Improv Olympic opened up. This woman, Sharna Halpern, ran it. And basically took Del, who was fired at the time, who was not working with Second City. He was just this genius without a home. And took him in, and he became the guru for Improv Olympic and started this long form called The Herald.
Yeah.
Which has become, you know, the thing that everyone tries to learn when you're starting out doing long form improv. It's really hard to learn, but it's one of these things that if you learn how to do it, you can pretty much do anything.
And The Herald, as I understand it, is a sort of a structure whereby all of the performers share a group understanding of how something might unfold.
You can maybe apply that definition to a lot of improv shows like ASCAP, but the format of the Herald in particular is you start with getting one suggestion from the audience, just a word, and then you do an opening with the whole group where you generate ideas based on that word, hopefully funny ideas. And then you start three separate scenes based on three separate funny ideas. You do three scenes. And then you do a second beat of those three scenes where you heighten and explore what we call heighten and explore the premise that's already there. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of doing our whole course in a 10 minutes here.
But perfect.
You take what the focus of the funny is. Like if you look at any sketch that's on SNL and you say, what essentially is this scene about? What's essentially, it's not a collection of funny lines like in a sitcom. There's one focus of the funny in each sketch you see.
One game being played.
That's what we call the game. Okay. You say that, that's Del's language. Like even you saying the game in the scene, like where'd you get that from?
I think I got that through clowning.
But I'm telling you, that comes from Del.
Okay.
That comes from this improv language, saying the game of the scene. So you getting in clown college makes me go, they got that somehow from Chicago and Del.
That's interesting because there are presumably discoveries being made all over the world. Although it's certainly American improv is known.
Sure, there's
like
Keith Johnstone. He did this thing called Impro.
I've read that book. I mean, that was a
totally different thing though.
Sure. Okay.
What he does, I would any improv and Keith Johnstone hearing this are going to hate me.
Ah, okay, go on.
I do not respect improv.
Okay.
Oh, hold on. I respect it, but I don't like it. It's not at all what I do. It's not at all what Del does. Del didn't like Keith.
Okay.
Keith didn't like Del.
I had no idea about any of this. Okay.
It was competing improv philosophies.
Yep.
Keith's whole philosophy is based on story and narrative.
Okay.
Del's is not. It's based on the game of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a sketch, on SNL, do you say, oh, that was a great story. I really enjoyed the story of that sketch. Nope. No one does that.
Sure.
They just say, that was funny.
Yeah.
What they're saying is, I like the game of that scene. You don't look at a sketch like, let's tell a story that starts here, it has a middle and an end.
I don't
look at a sketch that way.
I have to say, the stuff that I loved most in the Keith Johnstone book was the earlier part of the book where he is talking about the techniques through which you allow yourself to stop editing yourself. And that you allow yourself, you give yourself permission to say the first thing on your mind.
Okay, I like
that
too.
I think that's the stuff that made the biggest impact on me.
I like that too. That's called getting out of your head. That's another phrase that's been in the improv community for a while. Like you're in, like I said, I started out as a stand-up and then did improv. And when I started doing improv, this woman, Sharon, when she found out that ran the Improv Olympics, she said, oh, you're a stand-up? You're not going to do this well.
Yeah, sure.
She literally told me that. Like, you never tell someone they're not going to do something well because then they'll just prove you wrong. But
and what did she mean by that? What did she expect?
That stand-ups, they're used to being in their own head. I don't have to share what's in my head with anybody else, except for when I step up to the microphone, then I'm sharing it. In other words, as soon as I'm on stage with someone else, then I'm working with someone else. And the funny that's in my head, I have to share with them. And there needs to be a technique for sharing stuff. And that's why when people see improv shows and they're impressed, they're like, how did you guys do that?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, there's this technique we're doing. There's this format that we're doing that you can't just be funny. Or people might think you can, but I don't. I don't think you can just be funny and step on stage and be a great improviser. And you can be funny as shit, the funniest stand-up in the world, but be a really shitty improviser because you're only used to being in your own head, because you only need to be in your own head.
Okay.
I don't have to be on stage and think of a way to create a scene with someone else. And she was right, because there was like a period of a year where I had this attitude of, I wouldn't say it out loud, but in my head, I was like, what I'm about to say is funny.
Yeah. Okay.
What I'm about to say is funny. I hope this guy on stage with me gets it. And is as funny as me. I wasn't even thinking, let's both of us create something funny together.
Sure.
I was just thinking, I'm a stand-up. I get laughs every night. I know I can get laughs. So here's a funny idea. Let's see if he can keep up with me. It was a really bad attitude to have.
Yeah. The difference between you were transmitting and getting excited about transmitting rather than being excited about listening.
Yes.
And sharing.
Exactly. Okay. And it took me... Because you don't always get punished for it, because you're still being funny on stage.
Okay.
And the eyes are still laughing at you.
You're getting rewarded.
You might not be creating a great scene that you could write up and have it be a sketch, but you may be getting laughs in the moment based on doing a funny voice or based on doing references or being jokey or several other ways of being funny that don't involve the other person on stage with you. But as you realize, as you become in a group, you're like, I don't like that from other people. So why are the people don't like it from me? I want someone I can trust. Trust is a big word. Like, I'm not going to go out there and present you something and you're going to undercut me somehow for your own joke. If that's going to happen, I don't like working with you. I don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be in a group where I throw out something and know you're going to build with me. And it took me at least a year. And I was on stage one time with someone who I thought, and this is a snobby way to put it, but I thought was as funny as me.
Yeah.
Because I think, a lot of stand-ups, and you have to go on stage going, I'm the funniest guy in the room. You have to have that attitude, So that's the attitude I had. And this day, I was on stage with someone who I respected. We started doing a scene. I heard something he said, and it occurred to me, that's funny. I want to build on that because I have an idea on how to build on that versus what funny thing do I have in my head?
Okay.
And it was an epiphany, and I'll never forget. I know where I was standing. I know who the guy was. I know who the teacher was. And it wasn't even about the teacher pointing out something to me. It was just about realizing something on stage. I was like, building was so much more fun than me trying to force my idea onto this other person. Building together, my improv changed from that moment on. I remember, and I was in a good group, and a guy in the group told me after the next show, or a show very soon after that, "Hey man, you're in a lot better. What happened?" Like, and I don't even think I could put it into words at the time. Like, at the time, I don't think I was mature enough to go, "You've had a shitty attitude about being on stage till now." I think it's just something that organically happened. And in hindsight, I look back on my younger self and I was like, your ego was way out of control when you started improv.
Sure. And that's part of the genetic makeup of a stand-up. Like you say, I'm the funniest guy in the room. To survive, you need to have that ego at least as an option.
Yeah, especially when you're starting, because if you don't, when you bomb, it may ruin you. So you have to believe. It's the audience's fault I bombed.
Yeah, I had to grow. Oh, that was a bad room.
Right. Yeah. Versus that was me. And I'm not funny. So you eventually have to get that attitude. And to me, if you don't have a killer set in like the first five times you go up, I don't know how you'd survive.
Yeah.
Like the first time I went up in front of, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm bragging, dear listeners. He told me to brag before we
started this. This is completely inappropriate.
The first time I went up was in college. And the only reason I did it was because there was a contest. And if you won the contest, you'd get a free spring break to Jamaica. And I just wanted to go to Jamaica and get high. So I was like, let's do this stand-up contest. It was this gum called Sticklets, I think. And they were doing a national stand-up contest. And they came to the university that was right next to my college. And there were 2,000 people in the audience that night. So imagine the first time you go up. Like, I've had very few 2,000. I've probably had 20 of those my whole career. Yeah, and this is my first time going up. Because the University of Massachusetts, it was a giant university. And I went up, and my best friend was also doing it that night. And the host was Judd Apatow. How crazy is that? And this is when he's only probably 3 years into doing stand-up at this point. So he's a nobody. Okay. He's like Adam Sandler's roommate at this point.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm friends with Judd now, and I sent him a review of that night where I did well and my friend did well, and we were both singled out in the review as doing well. Judd was called out in the review for being a stage hog and doing too much material. And I did well, but it was only on accident because I was so nervous from being on stage the first time, being in front of that many people, that my hands were shaking, like visibly shaking. I could not manipulate the microphone stand to my liking. So it looked like I was struggling and I was stuttering. I was like, I was shaking. I don't think I was flop sweating, but I was stuttering. I was shaking. People thought I was doing a Bobcat Goldthwait impression to my benefit. And I was doing my material, which I had totally memorized word for word, which is a bad idea. It took me a couple of years to learn. Don't memorize your act word for word. It's just going to make you stumble. It's rather get a gist of your act.
Yeah.
But it was in my head word for word. And I remember getting lost in my act. It was something about Captain Kirk and hooking up with green aliens with three breasts. I don't know what it was. It was something stupid like that. But I was like skipping around in my material. Like I saw the script of my material in my head and I was like trying to find it and skip it. Like my material wasn't in any kind of order that made sense. But to the audience, I just looked like this manic, like I was doing a character, like, ah, blah, 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 Captain Kirk, man. So they thought almost like I was just doing this all as a choice. Like I'm just go up and do a wild energy. So anyway, it was a wreck of a set. I wish I had a recording of it, but I did great. And the other comedians, believe me, they were in the same boat I was. They were all starting, so they all sucked. We all sucked. But I guess I sucked the least, so I did really well. And it was in front of 2,000. Once you have 2,000 people
incredible.
Laughing at you, you're like, all right, this is what I'm going to do.
You often hear of someone having a killer gig within, like you say, within their first five, because that's they need, you know, you need that to go on. But it's normally to 10 men and a dog in the middle of nowhere. 2,000 people watching you, by your standards at the time, murder.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, that's incredible. What?
And I didn't have that feeling for a long time after that either.
I was going to say, how long did that sustain you for? How many bad gigs did you,
in college, and I didn't do anything else in college, but as soon as I graduated, I mean, that changed my whole life that night. I was like, I want to do this. And like I said, stand-up was a huge boom right now. So it seemed like not a too crazy idea.
It's the secret door. The little door opens up in the universe and someone goes, psst, this way.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm going to do it. My friend was going to spend the summer in Boulder, Colorado, and I had nowhere to go. And I was like, I'll just go to Boulder and I'll start doing stand up in Boulder and Denver. And I'll just try it out. So I did there was a strip club in Boulder called the Bus Stop. So I went there every Sunday. They have these things called blue laws. We can't sell alcohol on Sundays. So they don't have strippers on Sundays. They have just stand up. So I'd go and I was also just beginning. So I was always the first person out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the clientele, English was their second language, and they didn't know that Sundays had blue laws, and they thought there was stripping there.
Yeah.
So I had over and over the experience of, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Bester walking out and people going, where's the stripping? What is this? So that was my first regular gig. Was that my first bomb was at the Comedy Works in Denver. And I'll never forget that too. Like it was a packed room. And I think we only all got 4 minutes. I don't think I got one laugh. And that was at the point that if you don't get a laugh, it just starts, you can let it crush you. And I did get that flop sweat. And now I would know how to tell my younger self to get out of that. But at the point I didn't, it just went, it was just a complete all crickets bomb in front of a packed house. And that almost ended my career the way that college gig started it.
Because
my buddy who was there in the audience, he's like, let's go get go buy you a shot after the show. And he buys me a shot. He's like, I don't think you should ever try that again. That was really hard to watch you do that.
Just if you could pop your head through time, what would you say to bombing Matt Besser at that age? You know, in specifically in that circumstance.
Well, I let the audience know that I was bombed. I let them, they could see I was bombing. And what I've told younger comedians that I've seen, who give a shit about what I would say, I guess, but that I hate it when I see stand-ups when they're working out material, start to blame the audience for what, like while they're on stage, like say something about the audience, or you guys don't get it, or even if they don't blame the audience and they're blaming themselves, they're like, I suck. And unless it's Kindler making a whole act out of it.
Yeah.
I think it's a waste of everyone's time. I think it's the waste of the audience's time. It undercuts whoever's going to follow you because it's bringing the energy down. And also, stage time is precious. Just do your act. And that's why I always say to people, just do your fucking act. Because at the very least, you're getting the words of your act out. And you're getting some practice with it. You saying, I'm not funny, or you guys don't get it. Like, how's that fucking help? What do you learn doing? You're not learning anything doing that. And all it does is make their ego feel a little bit better in that moment, but it doesn't make you a better stand-up, and it really bothers me. And I did it. I think it's a knee-jerk beginning comic thing to do, but it's like, get over yourself, do your fucking material, and don't let them see you sweat, because as soon as they do, they're done with you.
Mm. So how did you discover improv from that? What was the journey from?
This is before the internet. I feel really old, but you know, I went, and this is the stand up boom. So I was like, I'm going to go to one of the bigger cities and start doing stand up. And I was too intimidated to go to LA or New York. They seemed too big. So Chicago was like, it was one of the biggest cities that had a ton of stand up coming out of it. So it was a logical, great place for a stand up to start in that time. So I went to Chicago specifically to start doing stand up. Didn't know it was improv. I remember getting there and I knew what Second City was and the sketch they did there. And I was interested in that too, because I loved Kids in the Hall and I wanted to be the next.
Yeah. I remember part of the next Kids in the Hall. Yeah.
And that was about that same time period that they were really popular. So I would go to shows there, and then you started to hear about improv. They would do an improv set, theoretically, at the end of their sketch set. And then I heard about, then through reading listings, I heard about the Improv Olympic. I went to the Improv Olympic. I saw a show and my life changed. I was like, I cannot believe what they just did. And I did that thing. I went up to him. I was like, all right, how'd you, I went up to Tim Meadows, who was nobody at that point. And Dave Koechner, I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I know who Dave Koechner is. Yeah.
But they were just nobodies. At the point, Chris Farley was on stage. So the first time I saw improv, Chris Farley was in. So imagine that. You're like, wow, these guys are on another level of funny. And how do they do this? So I went up to Tim and I was like, how you guys do that? You definitely wrote that. There's no way you could have, you guys sang that whole song together. How could the, you guys have sung that song together before, right? No, no, it's all made up. I thought they were lying.
Yeah.
Like the way you'd talk to a magician. It's magic. All right, buddy. Then I took a class and I realized, oh, there is a skill, there is a format. And then soon I was with Dell, who was like, because this was back when it was very nascent. There weren't many people in the scene at all. It was all straight white men. I mean, it was such a small, specific, not diverse group at all in the beginning. It, like, even just getting women on it, just one woman on a team was a challenge back then. Just because there weren't many in the scene. It wasn't any judgment. It was just like they
got better things to do with their time.
I don't know.
Social relationships.
Well, also think about stand-up. There weren't a lot of female stand-ups. Like women weren't treated the same in comedy back then. Maybe they're still not, but they definitely didn't get respect back then in the improv world. And I say Tim Meadows was there. He was about the only black guy for miles in that scene. Were there any Asians or Hispanics? I think not. Horatio Sands eventually. But I'm saying it was just a really small, not diverse scene at that point. But once I got a taste of it, I was like, this is what I'm better at than stand-up. This is, I like playing off of someone. Like even last night, I did Andy Kindler's alt show. And I asked him if I could do the bit with him. I was like, don't leave the stage. I'd rather play off you than just do the character to the audience. I just enjoy working with someone else more, which is not, as I've told you, is not how my mindset was when I started. Sure.
So this is Matt. Loads more from Matt coming up soon, including a bit of a delve into some of his own psychology, his own bad habits in improv. And we also identify the one type of comic that Matt will not perform with. So all of that to come. Remember, Pot Humor is available, Matt's new stand-up special. That's available wherever stand-up comedy is found online. And just a couple of other bits and bobs. I'm in Estonia at the moment. I'm in Tallinn, at the Tallinn Comedy Festival. So my great thanks to Andrus for bringing me out here. It's my third time in Estonia, and it's my first time tonight hosting a gala in front of 1,500 Estonian people, where every other act on the bill is Estonian, and we'll be speaking Estonian. So that will be... no, you haven't gone mad or fallen asleep. I don't speak any Estonian. But the language skills of the people here is as perfect as the free Wi-Fi which pervades the city. I can't wait for that. So that's really good fun. I'll talk to you a little bit about that. I had a lovely show last night, and I'll talk to you about that in the post-amble. Andrus did mention at dinner last night that he guiltily confessed to listening to the podcast on 1.5 speed. He said for a long time this podcast was the only one he didn't listen to on 1.5. He actually took his time with it, but now he's a father of two and has got to get a lot of things done. I hereby extend my blessing to anyone that wants to listen to this show on 1.5 speed. I've been doing it myself with some audiobooks recently, notably Philippa Perry, The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read, and also a Seth Godin book called This Is Marketing. I had a very long drive recently. I listened to them all on 1.5, and it's like all the information gets rammed into your head. So if you are already listening at 1.5 speed, then you might not be able to understand this bit, but I don't mind, and it's absolutely fine with me. Furthermore, if you are in the Facebook group, there's a brilliant conversation going on there at the moment with over 150 posts about people's favourite short jokes.
I'm going to read some examples of ones I'd never heard before. And they're some of these very best ones. What I love about the people in the podcast Facebook group, everyone's very polite and they're very often crediting the jokes. BNAG, that's bang out of order. Tim Vine, what a joke. I'd never heard that one before. An old Stephen Fry line from I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, submitted by Elliot Clark. That's Countryside, The Murder of Piers Morgan. Fantastic. Rupert Nevin has chimed in with a favourite from the Viz letters page. Avoid the expense of personalised number plates. Mr. KBL941Y Lincoln. Lovely. And of course, our wonderful Mitch Hedberg sent this one posted by Stephen Trumbull. I used to do drugs. I still do, but I used to too. Oh, Mitch Hedberg, what a wonderful joke writer. So all of those in the Facebook group, if you would like to look or contribute to those, it remains an extremely friendly corner of the internet. So please do find it by typing it into a Facebook, the searchy bit. You know how that works. Also, if you are in the Insiders Club, there's no extras from this particular episode. We just did an hour and 10 straight through. However, there is an episode that I'm going to release on the Insiders feed with a man called Sheldon, who is, he's a man called Sheldon. That's fantastic. But he is a bit of a marketing whiz and he is touring with his own band, the Lancashire Hot Pots, and they are doing incredible things with marketing. So we do a You Interview Stew where he talks to me about my own thoughts on marketing and strategy and things like that. And it's a really interesting interview because he knows, like, I'm keen to learn, but he's very... he's a very good teacher in that he is happy. I'm not being disingenuous about this. I'm just wording it carefully. It was like after the interview, my wife had heard it from within the house and was like, are you all right? Because I think I did a bit of like, well, I don't know what I'm doing with this and I don't know what I'm doing with that. So I think if you are in the Insiders Club, it will be a particularly interesting chat. So other content coming soon there as well with Alan Oakes about the music industry and touring as a musician. We do an interview, Stu, about that as well. Plenty of stuff coming along. Comedianscomedian.com/insiders for all of that stuff. That's that. Let's get back to Matt Besser, who you can find at mattbesser.com and at Matt Besser at Twitter and Instagram. He's either a very early adopter or he has a very unique name. Let's get back to Matt.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What was it dumb luck that you fell in with Dell's camp as opposed to the other camp?
Well, what camp are we talking about? Johnstone? That didn't really exist.
No, you were talking about the difference between Second City and what Dell was doing.
Well, everyone was doing both, really.
Okay.
Like it was, like I said, it was a very small scene. So everyone was trying to get into Second City. And if you wanted to do improv, you were probably doing Improv Olympic. There's another place called The Annoyance. I don't know if you've heard of them. They started the Real Life Brady Bunch. Andy Richter came from there, Matt Walsh. Anyway, there were like three main comedy theaters, but Second City was the only place where you could get a career because that was where SNL would come and look at everybody. So everyone wanted to get into Second City, but everyone also knew Dell was the man. And he was way ahead of everybody on this new thing. Like it was dumb luck and it was crazy. It's cool to be at the beginning of something like you are at the beginning of podcasting. You're going to be able to look back in 10 years and go, I was there at the beginning of UK podcasting, you know, it's a cool thing to be there. So I very much lucked out being with Dell in Chicago at that time. And he hadn't directed anyone in a long time. And because he was such a fuck up as a human, as with his addictions and everything, people didn't want him. He just wasn't a responsible director, you know, in general. So when he started directing our group, it was a great honor. And unlike a lot of acting classes I've taken or other improv classes, when you always left his class going, wow, he just gave me something. He just gave me something I can use. And I'd never, like, I'd taken a couple acting classes at that point where I was like, I don't know what just happened in there. I don't, I hear what they're saying, but they're not giving me anything that either isn't obvious or that I believe I can apply. Like, I'd always in an acting class going, I don't think I did that right, or I didn't get that,
or
it's a farce, or whatever. And this was the first class I'd taken a few improv classes before Dell, where I was like, this seems like a waste of time. This seems really corny, because I think a lot of improv is kind of corny. But when he was no nonsense, and he was all about taking your comedy from real life. And when I say no nonsense, like, if I was just a 20-year-old with zero life experience at that point. So we would like tell a story and he'd be like, that's bullshit. And then there would be another guy in class. There was this one guy in class who was older than the rest of us, who was a janitor in a prison. And he wasn't that funny of a guy, but he had these stories that were amazing. And he was like the teacher's pet. So all these other guys who are younger and funnier, arguably, had no life experience to talk about and pull the truth of their comedy from. But this guy did, and Dell would always love his stories and always gravitate to whoever had the most interesting life.
That's interesting. There's parallels there between that. I mean, I've done kind of clown classes where you're working on something and it's shit, and the person teaching the class is sat there. I mean, one guy would sit there and go, like that, as you know, because you're not being funny. So he's doing a plane crashing mime and a kind of a noise. And I think that the thing that listeners of this show will be most familiar with is Philippe Goliath in France. I don't know if you're aware of Goliath. So he is this famously irascible kind of character, similarly kind of insulting and haranguing the people who are trying to be funny. He studied under a guy called Jacques Lecoq, Ecole Jacques Lecoq in France. And that's where I've got the idea of the game Le Jeu from. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of have a clowning thing. And a whole route that was obviously developed in parallel, you know, sort of discovering the games, discovering what things to...
Now this makes me want... Because now it sounds like you could be saying, oh, no, in the world of clowning, we've had this phrase too. Now I want someone to research this.
Yeah, what's the link?
And go back. Is there a link, or
is it just parallel development? Yeah.
I find it hard to believe that it's just coincidence.
Yeah,
because even the word game becomes confusing. Because I was calling a short form, the Who's Line. Mm-hmm. We call those games.
Sure,
but we don't find. But we don't say it. We're using the same word game, but we're using it in a different way. So it's confusing to people who aren't in improv. They're like, I know improv games. We're like, no,
not games like that. Yeah, sure.
Not that. And that's why I like to use when I'm teaching. I like to say the focus of the funny, because that makes people maybe understand it a little quicker. And then I'm like, that's what we call finding the game.
But I wonder if there is something essential about it that could be discovered in parallel, whether it's in America or France or Indonesia.
But why would they use the same word?
Well, because you would be playing a game. There is something childlike about it. You're trying to find... And I don't mean like a Who's Line game. I mean like a what is the game of the scene? What is someone trying to achieve?
But why isn't the word essence or something? Find the essence. Like, why is it game?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, listen, if there's a super nerd out there who's going to research it, chances are they're listening to this, so get on that and get back to us.
And now I'm going to find out, they've been using in the 1600s the clown college in Rome.
I mean, maybe Commedia dell'arte. I mean, that maybe they had some sort of game.
Well, there is a lot of Dell worked a lot with Commedia dell'arte.
Okay.
And I actually did a mask show, which I think you could say is Commedia dell'arte, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, right.
You sure choose a mask and it has an expression on it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there was definitely links that way. And that was the great thing about Dell. He was a scholar of the world, not just comedy. So he would bring in one thing he did, which a lot of my contemporaries would make fun of, is he did these Native American Indian chants sometimes. We would do it for we'd turn down the lights and chant like Indians for an hour in the dark. And you're like, what the fuck am I doing? I want to be doing comedy. Why am I chanting in the dark?
Yeah.
But then maybe not every experiment, but experiment like that, you go, we are developing group mind. We are.
Okay.
We're learning to work as a group here and learning to share.
I had a theater teacher once, maybe 20 years ago, who we went in for a class and everyone just washed each other's feet.
Oh, we were like, I would have loved that class.
Is this okay? I mean, there was no kind of suspicion about it at the time in the way that probably would be now. But it was like, is this a drama class? And you go, well, there is something that you're recognizing about the sort of slowness and the care with which you would wash someone who's not even necessarily your friend.
You go, there's a lot of emotions there.
There's some theater happening there, you know, there's something. So you referred earlier on to the fact that Dell was giving you something you could use.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I'm interested in drilling into that a little bit more. Like, can you give us an example of something that you felt you took out of a Dell class as opposed to any other class where you come out and went, oh, I've got some knowledge now. I feel like I've had teachers like that or a bit like that where you go, oh, that's just the machinery of my brain has clicked now and I understand something more deeply.
Well, one, the most basic one, which pretty much every improv school shares, is the phrase yes and.
Of course.
And having been a rookie at improv, having been a teacher at improv, and having been a teacher as a substitute teacher in the public school systems, and when I'm substitute teaching, played with improv with children from kindergarten to high school. Like every once in a while I'd go, we're going to just do improv today. Put down your books, because that's what I knew, and I knew they'd have fun doing it.
I was going, yeah, we got better again.
Right.
Do improv.
We got the guy with the crazy hair again. What you notice is people have this natural, predilection to go to the word no, to say no. And it's crazy. I say they, excuse me, say no more quickly than they say yes. And I don't know if they think it's going to get a laugh quicker or what, but I know it's out there. And it's one of the most common, easy building blocks of learning improv to explain to someone. If they introduce a concept and you say no to the concept, then the scene's over.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go. Or worse, if you deny the reality of what I'm saying, that's called denial. Another way of not playing yes and. If I say a doctor and you go, hey, grocer, why are you saying you're a doctor? Then you've ruined my idea for whatever the scene was we could have started. Also, I never trust you again.
Yeah.
Because you've undercut my initiation. But as easy as that is to say, yes, and it's a lot harder to actually do. And then people kind of misunderstand it of you say yes to everything. So if I go jump off a cliff, yes. It's like, no, I still need you to be grounded. And in the scene, my character wants you to jump off the cliff, but me as the comedian, the game we're playing, I don't want you to jump off the cliff.
I need to say yes to you, the performer, not
yes,
you,
exactly.
Character.
Yeah. And it takes a while for people to get that. And because beginner improvisers will just say yes to everything, and scenes become really silly that way. And some, I would argue, some theaters, the veterans are doing that too. And I don't like it. I'm like, you have to be grounded. And that was another thing Dell taught us. This phrase, play at the top of your intelligence. And people misunderstand that phrase a lot. They think it means bring all the smart references and the trivial things you know about any topic into any scene. That's not what it means. It means play the scene the way you would play it in the scenario. So if you're playing a doctor, you and I probably didn't go to medical school, right? So we don't have all the knowledge of a real doctor, but we can still play a doctor at the top of our intelligence the best we can. Just like if you got a scene in a show that was in a hospital, you could still play the doctor without having medical knowledge just by reading your line. So the same thing, you can still play at the top of your intelligence the best you, just react the way you would if you were a doctor in this situation. I don't need you to throw out a bunch of medical terms to prove you're a doctor. That's not the intelligence I'm looking for. I'm looking for you to be grounded. So one of the most common notes I give when I'm teaching is I'll go, All right, stop the scene. Is that really how you would have reacted to what he just said? Would you have jumped off the cliff? No, of course you wouldn't. You would die if you jumped off the cliff. So play at the top of your intelligence and say, okay, no, I'm not jumping off the top of the cliff. Off the cliff. Why would I do that? Just react the way you would, and the scene will go much better. Even if you think, and a lot of people think when they're beginning, everything that comes out of my mouth has to be funny. Nope. If you're grounding, that's all I was doing today, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was just grounding the whole
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And a non-improviser isn't caring that I'm doing that or maybe even observing that. But that was the skill I was bringing in, is any absurd thing that was said, I tried to ground it back in reality. And that's what we call justification. Justify why that absurd thing can exist in reality. If you don't exist it, if you don't justify it, then it's just absurdity. And I'm not a fan of comedy that's just absurd. Like even Monty Python, which people called absurd, I would argue it was justified absurdity. It was always, it always linked back to some truth in our world.
Yeah, it's not just random.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
So even if it's philosophers racing each other or whatever, we can take some string of it back to a reality, which is making us, and that's why we're laughing at it. And that's what Dell would try to find. What's the truth of that?
Mm-hmm.
Let's try to milk the truth of that for comedy, because that's what the audience is going to relate to and go, oh, I get that truth. And here's how they're shining light on a particular part of this truth. They're cranking up this little part of the truth. That's the game. So we call that the unusual thing. What's the unusual thing? And let's focus on that. And that's all a stand-up does. They'll throw out a top and go, hey, we all know about going through the TSA at the airport, right? So that's the truth. And they'll go, you know, when they ask you those questions, when you go through the line and ask you how your day is, everyone knows that truth. And then the comedian will just focus on that. And then he'll go, what if? And he'll do a what if and make it just a little bit more absurd to show you the absurdity that that thing already has in our life, right? But the first thing the stand-up does is let you get you on board, as I like to say. It's like, let me get the audience on board. Okay, now you're on board with what I'm talking about. Now let me point at the unusual thing, and now let me crank that unusual thing up a few beats, and that's my stand-up. And that's the same way improv works, too.
And
I would say improv does not work that way.
Okay. Oh, you make a distinction between the term improv and improv.
Well, it's a whole...
Or do you mean specifically
John Stoney? Think it's the same thing, and I'm like, it's not. They're just, what can I compare it to? It's like hip-hop and country. They're both music, but they're just not created in the same way at all. They might both have lyrics, but they're not created in the same way at all.
And so the distinction you drew before was that the Johnstonian model is about narrative and about story.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a similar distinction? Is there like a parallel distinction to be drawn in now in terms of the process? Like the process is aiming at story, whereas your process is aiming at comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds snobby to say, and I'm sure an improv person would argue with me and say, my story is funny. What are you talking about?
Sure.
But I would say to them, if this is what I always say.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of outside improv just in whatever you'd call our type of improv. I think there's improv teams who say, oh, we do stories too. They wouldn't call it improv. They'd say, we have a narrative structure.
Mm.
And I'd say, if you have a narrative structure, like we do a form called the movie that Dell worked with us on, where we take the structure of any movie, a baseball movie. But we weren't doing a parody of baseball movies. We were using the structure of a baseball movie to do scenes that we all recognize. And within all those scenes, we try to find an unusual thing and find a game in all those scenes. But we weren't concerned with telling a story that
sure.
anyone would be interested in. We're like, we're going to tell the baseball movie story everybody knows. We're going to tell the Western story everybody knows.
Because the archetype allows you to get
yes.
on the same page
so we don't have
and listen
to, exactly.
more
and we don't have yeah. to worry about coming up with the story. And I say to people who say we improvise narratives, I'm like, oh yeah, are they interesting? Can you tell them the next day to somebody? Because if they're good, you should be able to tell them the next day to someone, right? And improv used to have that reputation of, oh, you got to be there.
Yeah.
I hate that. If you got to be there, it wasn't that funny. my podcast, you don't have to be there. Obviously, we tape it and you can listen to it 5 years later. Yeah. So you didn't have to be there and it was still funny. If you think you're doing narrative improv, I think you're saying the story is worthwhile. If it's worthwhile, you should be able to say it the next day. And if you're able to improvise a story or a movie or whatever, holy shit, you're amazing. Most writers have to spend 6 months on a movie, but you can just improvise and it's great in 30 minutes. That's fucking amazing to me. So great job, Impro. You guys can do what writers, it takes them months to do. You can do like that. I don't buy that.
Why does that frustrate you though?
Because I don't have never seen it. And I've said many times, send me a tape. I'll send you a tape of my improv. It's obnoxious, I know. I don't do that anymore, but back in my 30s when I was very, it was like gangs.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yeah. I would yell at short formers. I have a memory of yelling at a short former on the snowy streets of New York. Like, short form sucks, you motherfucker. Just getting really angry about it because it also is about who gets to be on TV, too. Like, name a long form improv show on TV. You can't. So that was our frustration too. We wanted to be on TV and only short form was getting on TV.
Is that the basis of it? Because that, like, there's real anger there. That's, you know what I mean? Like the gang thing, that separation that has to be motivated by something. And I guess TV, life-changing amounts of money, life career-changing opportunities.
Believe me, I have pitched many a show through my, however long I've been doing this. Probably every 3 years I pitch an improv show where they try to make it into a short form show because they want all the bells and whistles and it frustrates you.
Do you feel like a success?
My 6-year-old daughter makes me a success, Stuart.
That's a wonderfully American
now
answer.
We can stop. Does any comedian feel like a success? I don't know. I feel I'm a success in that I make money off of comedy enough that I can keep doing it. And my thing is I like to experiment. Like even the Improper Humans, we kind of skip past this, but I wasn't working with improvisers per se. So we decided to do a concept episode where I interviewed them as industry people. So I like experiments. I like doing that. I like having that freedom to say, I want to try doing this thing today. So I find success in that. That might not be fame or money success, but the ability to do that, I think, is success on one level because not everybody has that. So there's that level. I do want a money success level. I guess that's all relative to how old you are. In your 20s, you know, $10,000 can be amazing, but in your 50s, it's not. So that's always changing. And then there's like fame stuff. Like when I was younger, I was like, I want to be famous and da 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 da. I think I'm mature enough that I don't need whatever 20-year-old Matt Besser thought that was. And I don't think I ever thought like I need to be a star of a movie like Adam Sandler. I don't think I ever thought that, but I thought I would like to be the third banana on a sitcom, sure. Like, and I still would like to be, but I don't look at it as I'm failing till I get that, I guess, to answer your question.
Yeah. But
you were asking about improv. I feel like in improv, yes, I'm a success. But what does that mean in improv? Is my type of improv a success? No, because there's never been a long-form show on television anywhere. We've had ASCAT on as a special twice, but it's never been a
I saw
series.
It on YouTube and I assumed it was part of a series. They were just specials.
We've had two different ones. One was made by Bravo a long time ago. I feel like in 2000 or something.
I think that must have been the one I saw, yeah.
And then there was another one, but it's also on YouTube, that we made at our theater, and we made it with a production company, Shout Factory. And then Comedy Central bought it as a special and they ran it a few times. So it was on Comedy Central as a special and the other one was on Bravo as a special, but never as a series.
Why not?
I have a lot of cynical reasons.
Give me your cynical theories as to why not. Because the one I saw, and I couldn't tell you which one it was. I didn't recognize the venue, obviously.
Was Tina Fey in it?
Yes.
That was the first one.
That was the first one. I was crying laughing in 5 minutes.
And that wasn't as good as the second one.
Ah, I watched the second one as well on YouTube. It was really funny.
We were really uptight that night because it was being filmed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't our stage either. And we were used to always doing it on our stage. It was like on a stage, a TV stage, which are terrible. It was okay. I thought the second one was on our stage and we were much more comfortable. So I like that one a little bit better. And I still feel like if we got in a series, that's when it would get good because you have to get used to the TV aspect of it.
Is TV too scared to take the risk of people improvising?
Well, is it a branding
issue? What is it?
Well, one thing is they want a lot of bells and whistles. And if you've seen the improv shows that have, I don't know what's on in UK per se, but it's funny how we'll get, here's an improv show from Australia. Or here's one from Japan, like places I'm like, I have to get an improv show from fucking Japan and it started in Chicago where I was and I got to get a format from another fucking country. I don't think that makes me xenophobic. It's like,
is there other format to it or is it just simply the fact it's exotic and that's why it gets?
No, there is. There's huge format to it. And to me, there's so many bells and whistles. There was one format. I can't remember the names of these shows. There was one. And I'm sure a couple of these probably do come from Britain. There was one where the improvisers are on a stage that's at an angle.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And the angle of the stage keeps changing through the whole show. Yeah. So they're sliding down it.
Yeah.
And then they'll add like soap suds or slime, whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
Are you going to wear something on your head?
And
or
all
something?
Of this stuff, is it angers you because it's perverting
bullshit.
The purity of your basic thing. You're like, this thing that I do is vital and important and simple. Why don't you just fucking do that?
Yes. And also, what the fuck is that? Who enjoys that? I don't even know if I respect a person who wants to see someone do improv and slide down a stage of soap suds.
Sure.
What am I, 13?
Every time I've spoken to anyone, this podcast is in its third century of episodes, and everyone on TV I've ever spoken to about this has basically said, oh, long-form conversations that follow a thing, can we just have the 7 minutes where they cry? But no, you can't have that. This is its own thing.
Oh, the podcast aspect of
it. Yeah. Like, you know, I suppose I empathize in some small way with like, no, this thing is perfectly good like I do it.
Right.
Why don't you do that?
The other aspect is if you're in development, if you're on the development side of TV, you're used to reading scripts and giving notes and going back and forth. And by the time it's showtime, everybody up the ladder has approved this script. So if
and
it fails,
contributed to it in some small way.
And also if it fails, everybody saw it. Don't blame me. We all saw this. We all gave notes. Not my fault it failed. But an improv group, if I'm the developer and I say to the people above me, believe me, the UCB should have a show. They do great. Let's do this. And it doesn't do well. There was no scripts to judge. It's all on that one person.
Yeah. That's crazy.
That's one of my cynical takes on it.
That is how, you know, spotting those things, like whose advantage is it in TV if it works? Just the one person that booked it. And that's, yeah, of course.
But it'd be advantaged because think of how little money it takes compared to making a sitcom.
Nothing. And you would think now with the incredibly vast amount of streaming services, subscription services, channels, you know, I mean, could you?
I literally last week with my manager, a couple of new streaming services, because anytime there's someone new in the game, I'm like, let's pitch them Ass Cat, let's pitch them Improv for Humans, let's pitch them something like that. And he was like, oh, no problem. Because I also had a great cast attached. Usually that'll change anybody's name or mind. And I just got back work 2 days ago of these two companies. They're both huge. They're not doing sketch or improv. Just those are two huge words just to completely write off. We're not doing sketch or improv. It's like, really? You just don't even want to hear any pitch on those two huge genres of comedy.
Could you brute force it with huge names?
Could you have the amount of huge names? But even Whose Line, like it needed in the United States, it needed Drew Carey to kind of.
We did have two versions. We had Clive Anderson. I knew there was two different shows.
Well, but you guys
we had
came a lot first, of it. But yeah.
Did we really?
Yeah.
I was assuming we stole it from you. Oh, no way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I actually auditioned for the dude who, the producer of it at one point. they were doing some new Whose Line. It wasn't Whose Line, but it was like a spinoff of it. And that producer guy, I believe he's British, was in Chicago. And I came into the room. Oh no, I think I was in New York. I was part of UCB at that point. And I came into the room and he goes, how are you doing? And I just should have gone, fine. But instead, and as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was like, what am I saying? I said, well, I'm here auditioning for a short form show, so I can't be doing that great, or something like that.
Yeah, nice move, man.
I was like, why did I even come if I'm going to say something like that out loud? But anyway, no, you guys invented that format.
I spoke to someone who...
I'm sorry, my point was we needed Drew Carey, who was a stand-up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who doesn't know how to improvise. Sure. He had to be host of that show for it to be
a
sold.
A simple format that will ground it with a talent, with a name, in order that they take the risks. And even then, something like Whose Line, it's games, it's format, and this mm-hmm. is how it looks. Mm-hmm. And everyone up the ladder can have an opinion on mm-hmm. the order of the games and where they sit and all that.
And they write those scenes anyway.
No.
Yeah.
I don't
Sorry,
hear
folks.
That.
Sorry, folks. They don't write them as much as they know what everybody does the best.
Okay.
Like they'll know, okay, you can do this thing, so we're going to come up with a game that feeds,
of course, because this
feeds your thing into that.
Of course. Heartbreak.
So it's not even true improv, folks. Sorry to tell you.
Do you think that you have sabotaged
I'm
yourself?
I'm coming off so
with,
snobby.
Listen, you're entitled to be snobby. You're in the position. You know what I mean? You were responsible with your co-conspirators mm-hmm. for UCB, which is like this mm-hmm. enormous, it's a life-changing thing which has spawned venues and schools, and you've taught people and you've enlivened people, and you know, you've become your own version of Del Close.
Yeah, up to the point where I don't get work just like Del didn't.
Well, this is my question. Do you feel you sabotaged yourself with responses to that guy? Like, but you said the word obnoxious.
Like
you've said the word obnoxious a few times.
Well, it's maybe because obnoxious story is the most interesting. Believe me, folks, I'm not walking into every audition like that.
Sure.
I'm kissing ass and bending over backwards like every other actor. But at that point, I think we had just had Ass Cat rejected from being a TV show. So I was very bitter about short form and about this guy in particular, since he was the main guy of short form.
Understandably.
I think I've more... So I don't think I'm a guy who burns bridges like that, if that's your question. But I think maybe being a founder of the UCB Theater... This is, you're getting my bitter side. Is this when I cry? I'll get introed on stage a lot of, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Besser, the founder of the UCB Theater. And I hate that as an intro. It's gotten to the point where I'm like, can you please not say I'm the founder of UCB Theater? I'm like, introduce me for my podcast. Because I never dreamed of, I'm going to grow up and own a theater. It was never my dream. It's still not my dream. I'm proud of it, but I don't like that that's what defines me. I'd much be better defined for the bit I did at Annie Kindler's show last night than the founder of UCB. Because I feel like I like comedy, you know, I love my theater, but that's not what I set out to be in life. And that's not, I don't wake up in the morning going, how am I going to find joy for my theater today? I think, what comedy am I going to work on today? So as proud as I am of it, it's come to define me more than my comedy, and that is a frustration.
I had a friend I was chatting to who's at this festival who trained at UCB. There's more than one venue, is that right? There's more than one theatre?
There's four, yeah.
There's four. And he said that you would occasionally... He was scared to ask you whether the peaches you left by the foyer... He was in the foyer... You walked past and left some peaches and kept walking, and everyone let the peaches rot because they were too scared to ask if the peaches were intended to be a gift.
Okay. Let me back up on this. That is not about me. That is Matt Walsh, my partner, who has peaches in his yard and harvests his peaches.
Oh.
Walsh just gave me some peaches.
Okay.
So I don't like this peaches story, folks. I don't have a peach tree. I did not bring any peaches.
All I'm
to
describing,
anyone.
I think the point of the story is my friend said, he was like, "Oh, you got Matt Besser. Oh my God." He's completely from this position of really respecting you. And I was like, "There's something in your voice. You sound like you're scared of him." And you go, "Well, you know, he's a force, right?
I do have a Del Close reputation of maybe not the genius part, but the no nonsense part. As a teacher, I did as a teacher decide I want to give what Del gave to me, which was honesty, even if it was brutal. So when the four of us, the UCB, started teaching classes and started teaching, I was like, I want upper levels only. I don't want 101s. Because every 101 is terrified, and I don't want to be that way. To
a 101, you mean a beginner. Total novice, yeah.
I want the 401s. I want the advanced people so I can be like Dell. And if the scene's bad, I want to be able to tell them they're bad and they're not going to get their feelings hurt. Whereas if you're a 101, you will. So I took his mantle, I will admit to that, of being the harsh teacher. But I did it on purpose. I feel like it's necessary. I went through a lot of, at Second City and other schools, of people being too coddling. And we'd do a scene that was terrible. And they'd go, "That was great, guys." And there's this kind of hippy-dippy Montessori school. Everything's great. All improv is great. Just try hard. And I hated that. And I, especially since I had one foot in stand-up at the same time, which isn't that way at all. Mm-hmm. Like, stand-up doesn't give you any coddling. It's like the stand-ups don't give you calling, the audience doesn't, the bookers don't. It's just like, you better fucking prove yourself or you're dead.
Yeah.
So I had that mindset a little bit. So I hated, like, no, not all improv is good. And this sucks. And why did you tell me it was good? When we got to Dell, he would go, we'd be three lines into a scene. "All right, stop, stop, stop. You were acting like a complete moron up there. Would you ever act like that in real, you know?" And I was like, ugh. And everyone I know who was with him has a story of Dell, you know, taking them to task and it changing their life for the better, or their improv life for the better. Of like, he taught me to listen. Like, one time I was on stage, once again, my ego thinking, I'm better than this other improviser up here. And this is when I've been doing it a few years. And I'd gone back to do a Dell class just for fun. And in my head, I was thinking, I'm better than every improviser in this class. They're lucky to be on stage with me. And some kid was on stage with me and we were doing a scene and Dell stopped the scene. I was like, he's about to ream this kid. And he reamed me instead. And he told me, "You weren't listening to him in the scene. I had crucified the guy. I'd stuck both his arms up on a cross and I'd stuck a sandwich in his mouth. So he literally couldn't talk." He's like, "You stuck a sandwich in his mouth. You nailed his arm, so he can't take the sandwich out. So you're basically up there doing stand-up because your partner can't talk unless he's going to deny your reaction." And I'm like, "Oh, you're right. And why don't you listen to other people?" And I was like, blah, blah. And once he dressed me down, I was like, he's right. And I did start doing that. And I did snap my ego, and that was good. So I do like – I don't mind that reputation as a teacher anymore.
Do you still have, when you're improvising now in the podcast or on stage when you're doing ASCAT, whatever, do you still recognize bad habits in your own improv? Presumably you're not at a stage now whereby everything, you are simply a vessel and it all flows through
you. Bad habits would be more lazy habits, I think, than rookie mistake kind of stuff. It'd be like bringing out a bag of tricks, like there's certain characters I just like doing. I like doing my Nazi guy, so I might do it when it wasn't organic necessarily
We were in Belgium, right. not during the war.
right. Yeah, so okay. It's like, I try not to do that. You'll make a joke that undercuts the scene because you just like, that joke's just hanging out there. Yeah. You just want to fucking make it, but then it undercuts the reality. But if you do that too much, people, you'll get known as a stage hog, or people won't, like some of the, and like I said, the audiences don't necessarily realize that. So we'll have teams where maybe theoretically the funniest guy on the team is the worst improviser, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you're getting a lot of laughs, but your team doesn't trust you.
It's like when you're, and I know that hosting works differently in the US, but in the UK, if you're the MC, you're often paid best or paid equally to the headliner. Yeah. You're on and off throughout the night. And there's a thing whereby there's two schools of thought about whether the MC is there to serve the show rather than be the best thing on the show. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, great, the MC's nicked the gig. You know, they've kind of stolen it. Because,
well, like I'm doing an act right now that's all, my stand-up is all weed-based. It's all about marijuana. It's an hour on fucking marijuana.
Right? This is the 420 show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I let the MC know, because I don't want the MC doing marijuana material right before my act. And I think some MCs, because stand-up can be ruthless, or stand-ups will know, I know he's about to do his pop material, so I'm going to get my pop material out first.
Yeah, okay.
And that's very selfish, I think. Sure, it's like, sure. As the MC, you should allow me to have the first pop material in the show, and then after my set, follow up with your own.
Yeah, right.
Instead of undercutting mine.
Yeah.
And I would say most guys are good enough to not do that, but I'll see that competitive kind of thing every once in a while where it's like, oh, you know that next guy going up is going to do that kind of thing, so you got your stuff out first. That's obnoxious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Given that we have this opportunity to hear from someone who has kind of lived and breathed improv for years and years, what other kinds of... What, like, are there other bad habits you see pro guys doing, without mentioning any names, pro men and women doing that you, like, I'm just thinking from the perspective of someone who's learning improv.
There's a few people who I'd say are known as being great improvisers, who I'd say they're not great improvisers. They're just really funny.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't trust being on stage with them. And in fact, sometimes they'll get booked for ASCAT and I'll go, I'm not showing up tonight because I don't want to be on stage with them. Because they're selfish.
And does it benefit them? Do the good guys, the bad guys sometimes finish first? Because they get the laughs, they get known for being funny, and only you or a few other people in the room notice what they're doing.
Sometimes they don't even know they're doing something bad. They don't even care to parse what the good improv is. The good improviser is going to not be funny sometimes because they're servicing someone else's joke. They're being a straight man. If you listen to my podcast, I think you'll see the people who come back are good at being both. They can be the funny person or be a straight man. I point to a guy like, do you know who Drew Tarver is? Mm. He's a really funny young guy on a group called Big Grande right now. And he's now the star of a show on Comedy Central called The Other Two. He's one of the two leads. And this guy can be so fucking silly and funny. He's like one of those guys, like there's certain comedians who they just say anything and the audience is laughing. And they can be super silly and the audience is laughing. And he could get away with doing that all the time, but he doesn't. He's a good straight man too. He knows when to not be silly and to recognize the game isn't about him and just work at the top of intelligence to serve the game and not be silly. And so that's why I appreciate him, because I know he could do anything. He can say anything, get away with it. He can just talk. He can read the phone book, you know. That expression doesn't work anymore, does it? Because there's no phone books. But and there's guys who I'd say are famous and funny and I can't be on stage with because they'll undercut you at a moment's notice to get a joke out. And the audience doesn't know because they are getting a joke out. It is funny. It might be the funniest thing said that night. But if it undercuts something we're building, why do I want to perform with you?
Yeah. What can you see happening to the industry? We started off talking about that boom in the 80s. And obviously comedy has been through a huge kind of, it's continually being reborn and changing.
Yeah.
What do you think will happen with stand-up over the next 10, 20 years? And what do you think will happen with improv? Is there still enough? Can you make a living as an improv guy? Or do you have to...
The problem with making a living as improv guy, you can't really tour, which I wish I could, even with my show, Improv for Humans. To get four people on the road is four times as expensive as one person. So we're getting that one person's salary and splitting between four people. It just doesn't work. So there's that problem with touring. We do tours. We do college tours, but there's not a margin of profit. So if you're my age, I can't do tours like that anymore. stand-up, I don't see it ever going away. I don't see improv ever going away. It's more like how the growth or lack of growth is like, where is it in the places beyond live? We used to say just TV, but now it's all sorts of different kinds of platforms. So it's funny, like whatever, 10 years ago, web videos were all the hot rage. And I'm sure here, just for laughs, everyone was making videos and making money off videos. And that's where all the focus was. And now what is it this year? It's in the last couple of years, probably podcasts, like what you're doing. It's much more affordable to do a podcast than a web video, right? And I think everyone's organically discovered that. There's too many podcasts right now. You would like to feel just like any other genre of entertainment that has too many. Eventually it settles out and the people who are good and will subsist and keep going. So I think podcasting, we're in a boom right now. I think it'll settle at some point because the advertisers don't know how to give the money out now because there's so many people. It's just kind of random how they buy ad time. The streaming services, my hope is they'll take more chances because they need more content and they can only buy up so many stars because that's what they're all doing now.
Yeah.
It's like Apple starts a streaming service. They don't really have a point of view yet. So they're like, we'll just get some stars and put them in shows. And that's what it is. I feel like eventually they'll go, okay, we need some shows that don't have stars that are good. So then the streaming services will, that's where I'm hoping eventually long form improv can live.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't it? It's so, I don't know. It's my constant bugaboo. Is that a British word, bugaboo?
Bugbear.
Bugbear.
It might be your constant bugbear. Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy. Like I said earlier, I love being a comedian. I love festivals like this. I love doing shows that might not be my comfort zone. That's why I've seen you at a couple of festivals. I really like doing the festivals. I like doing different types of shows. So I find happiness. You know, my frustrations in life come from typical frustrations of life. Disease, you know, bad things happening in families and stuff like that. But as far as my career goes, do I want to be on a sitcom and be successful? Yes, but I'm not going to hold out and be the bitter guy, you know. Do I want Longform to be its own show? Yes, but I'm not irrational. So I'm not going to find my happiness from only that happening, bringing me happiness. You're looking at me like you're unhappy. Like.
No, not at all. I'm not at all. I just felt you were about to put a bow on the end of the
I didn't have a bow. I didn't have a bow. I'm just wondering how many, I guess I was in my head going, because I'm sure you probably interview more stand-ups than anything.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, that's such an angry life. Like if you get into that life or on the road, especially, and it's a lot of alone time and it's ruined a lot of people, that road life, you know, and it does cause bitterness and it's much tougher on the psyche, I think, being a stand-up. So I could see an honest answer being I'm not happy from a lot of stand-ups.
Sure.
But I could see them arguing with me going, I love being on the road and that's my life and
yeah,
whatever.
But you get to play with people and you never need to sit and write.
Well, I do write.
But you do as well. And I enjoyed the
people
the six...
talk about the difference between a green room, an improv green room, and a stand-up green room. You can imagine.
Sure. Yeah. And I enjoyed, the six phases of stand-up, that album that's currently available. Is this the six...
The six greatest
sets in the history of stand-up.
Yeah, that's one of my stand-up albums where they're all in character. I do like The Stuttering King.
George the Third. Yeah, George the Sixth.
Yeah, and doing stand-up. I do Bjork doing stand-up. I do the Pope doing stand-up. I do Satan roasting the baby Jesus. And it's supposed to be the best stand-up sets in the history of the world. And it's... go look on Amazon. I think it only has like a couple of reviews, but one of the reviews is a 1-star review that says, I was under the impression that this would be 6 different stand like he expected Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Joan Rivers.
And we got Bjork.
So if you're expecting to get the 6 best sets in stand-up, they're not on this album.
Thanks, Ben.
So that was Matt. Thank you very much to Matt Besser for coming onto the show. MattBesser.com or at Matt Besser all over social media. And do look out for his new special, Pot Humour. That's coming up soon wherever... Well, it's available now, in fact, wherever you get your video on demand. And if you're listening outside of America, you might need to do some sort of wangling to pretend you're inside America. I don't know. Find out for yourself. That's all of that. Thank you, as ever, to Nathan Wood for editing, uploading, producing the show. Thanks to J.K. Crossland for logging. Your podcast consultant was Peter Dobbing, and the music was by Rob Smouten. Now, I will post-amble at you what... Oh, I know what I'm going to talk about. So if you care to stick around for a little post-amble, then let's do that now. But otherwise, that concludes the podcast, and we'll be back next week with Greg Turkington, a.k.a. America's funny man, Neil Hamburger. That's an absolute doozy of an episode, and I suspect rather a long edit. Bye for now. Okay, so if you stuck around, thanks for sticking around. Someone asked a question on the Facebook group about the Lost episodes, and someone said, was there one with Nat Metcalf? There wasn't one with Nathaniel Metcalf, brilliant comic though he is. And I think he appeared on an episode of Redacted, a live show of Redacted, which wasn't released. But it's probably diggable, outable somewhere. I might put that on the Insiders feed when I get to it. Also, there's an episode with Omid Jalili, which was at a book festival. You might remember, this is years ago now. It was at the Chortle Book Festival, and I interviewed him, and we sort of planned to do it as a co-pro and also release it as a com-com. But that was a confusing sentence. But it just was too book-oriented to be strictly a com-com. So we said, hey, let's do it again some other time. And we haven't got round to that yet. So there is that one. And if I can find it, it must be from 3 years ago now, 3 Montreals ago. There's a lovely, warm, rambly episode with the fabulous K. Trevor Wilson, who you may know from Letterkenny. And if you're not watching Letterkenny, just watch the first 5 minutes of the first episode of Letterkenny, all one word. Letterkenny, I think. And oh my God, it's absolutely brilliant. So get stuck into that. I found that I've started using Instagram a little bit more, sort of as an experiment, just to kind of learn how to use it. The danger is I regard things like Twitter, you know, if you've ever tweeted at me, I regard Twitter as an inbox. I see everything and I reply to most things, but I'm not up there posting stuff because it just... I don't want to. I think it really serves and suits people who want to constantly be broadcasting. Now, obviously, your relationship with me is that I constantly broadcast stuff once a week. But I like that. I like kind of doing it in one little blurt. I don't really want to feel chained to my phone and feel as if I should be constantly putting out content, man. And then I was traveling yesterday, so I used Instagram a lot because I was lonely, frankly. I had left the house at 5 in the morning in order to get to Estonia. And I had these sort of thoughts about, you know, oh, I should buck up and use social media a bit more in my head. And I found that, and this isn't going to be news to anyone, I found that maybe because I follow, not exclusively, but mostly comedians, and maybe because the sorts of comedians who I follow are naturally, not even necessarily my friends. I've never really sat down and gone through my mates and followed all of them. Maybe I'm using it wrong. That would be a lovely conclusion to draw. But basically, I tend to follow people who are huge on Instagram because they're the people that pop up. You know, that Venn diagram of people I know whose work I like and who are huge on Instagram. No, I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to... There's nothing... I feel negative about Instagram itself, not any individuals. But I do find that I was lonely and I just felt like I was fulfilling the curse of social media, whereby I thought, oh, I could post something. That'll make me feel a bit less alone. Here's my breakfast in a Wagamama. Side note, if you ever manage to get to Heathrow Airport before noon, there's a Wagamama there that does a breakfast menu, and there's a sausage and nori omelette kind of roll. Oh my God. And sriracha. It's absolutely incredible. So yes, I took a picture of my food. What is this? 2006? Is that too early? Have I misplaced my Dateline reference? I've no idea. But I did. I just fulfilled the social media contract. What I did was I felt lonely. I took a picture of my actual breakfast, posted it, and then scrolled whilst I waited to see if anyone would react to it. I wasn't waiting, but I was kind of additionally scrolling on my own in an airport. And I saw lots of my friends doing successful things, and I became depressed. And it just made me laugh, actually, because the word actually suddenly makes that seem false, doesn't it? It made me laugh, actually. But it did. It actually made me laugh out loud at breakfast in a Wagamama in an airport, because I thought, my God, I've fallen hook, line and sinker for this. Instagram's no different from Twitter. It's all, you know, in terms of the machinations of... It draws you in with the promise of community, and then it spits you out. It's like going to a celebrity party. You think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to go to a celebrity party? And then you go to one, I imagine. I mean, I'm occasionally in green rooms after recording of TV shows, and it's a bit like, celebs. And actually what it is, you're a real person, and you're like, well, I'm not just going to walk up and say hello to a celebrity. And anyway, they're surrounded by a coterie of people hanging on their every word, just like social media. And it just, you know, you go to it and you think, oh, I'd sort of rather be with the people I know in the corner actually having a real experience. I think what we've learnt here is that I am undergoing the thing that everyone undergoes on first contact with social media, most of which happened about 8 years ago. But it just seemed like such a kind of perfect crystalline example of, I felt like I was in a training video of how not to use social media. Look at Stu. He's alone in an airport having breakfast. He's posted a thing. Now he's looking at more successful people than him, have loads of people engage with their stuff and pat them on the back. Now he feels sad. Don't be like Stu. So there's got to be a way to do it. And what I want to find is a way to use it in a way that makes me happy, that genuinely makes me laugh. Like the way that social media makes me happy, if you're friends with me on Facebook, with my private account on Facebook, you'll know that pretty much all I ever do is ask for general hive mind opinions on how to do efficient filing, how to lay a lino floor, whether a door needs to come off so that the lino floor could go under it, that kind of stuff. And I genuinely enjoy that. Maybe I'm in the wrong job. Maybe I should have some sort of amateur DIY YouTube channel. I enjoy that. And so much of life, I think, is trying to join the dots between what you love to do and what you have to do. And I think if I could find, and this goes out to lots of comics who I am sure are struggling in exactly the same boat, or some of you will have, not just comics, in whatever walk of life, social media is sort of a part of everything now, isn't it? If you're a baker, you should have an Instagram account. If you're a grave digger, you probably get away with it. But... you'd probably get away without, I mean to say. But so most of us, I think, will be in the position of thinking, oh, God, I should be doing this more. And here's a thought. What if they invent another 10 platforms? Have you got to fucking join all of those as well? Is it all going to be like my messaging apps on my phone now, where instead of just texts, for a while it was just texts, and then it was texts and WhatsApp, and then it's texts and WhatsApp and Viber and Telegram. And there are certain friends of mine that only use one of those, so I have to use all of them, so they're perpetually on. So where does that end? Is it going to be 10 years from now there's 150 different messaging apps and you've got to have them all? It's like that Josh Whitcomb joke about mini Argoses. Like, with this, why don't you just wrap all of those text messaging apps in one bundle and we'll just call it texts? Do you know what I mean? Anyway, that's some rambling thoughts from a hotel. I'm going to get outside soon. I'm going to edit this episode with Sheldon, upload it, and then I'm going to go and walk around a really... It's not torrential, but it is raining a bit, and it looks pretty cold and bleak, but I'm sure that Talon has got some lovely stuff to offer me. And here, it's 20 to 1, and it's not starting to get dark, but it's threatening to start to get dark in maybe 2 hours or so. So I better get my skates on. Lovely to talk to you. I feel like I've slipped into an accidental mode there of how you would normally end like an answer phone message. Lovely to talk to you. Cheerio. Anyway, that'll be me. is this just Stu goes mad in a hotel room? No, I'm absolutely fine. I'm sane. I'm getting things done. I have plugged my phone, my MacBook charger into two different adapters, and to get them to actually sit in the right place to fit the plug socket here in the hotel room. I've had to balance them on a glass of water. And it only occurs to me now, I could have taken the water out of the glass, but it looks funnier balanced on there. Which in turn reminds me of being in Zurich with lovely Phil Kay and seeing him blowing the... There was a hairdryer in the... Have I told you this before? There was a hairdryer in the bathroom. We were in his hotel room. And the hairdryer was in the bathroom on a coil such that it could just about reach the toilet. And so he was flushing the toilet and blowing hot air into the empty, just water in it, just clean water, into the toilet whilst flushing it and stirring the air around with the draft of the hairdryer whilst looking at me and saying, no one does this. So I think it has turned into Stugo's man in a hotel. So that'll be me. I'll get off and get on with my doings and you get on with doing your doings. And tell you what, let's meet back together in a week for more of this.